Hello, I'm Dan.
I'm Simon.
And this is the Wikicast, a podcast where Wikipedia takes us to a random article each week and we talk about what we find. Simon, what are we talking about this week?
This week, Dan, we're talking about Krauschwitz. I say again, Krauschwitz.
I'm scared already.
It's not... well, I suppose it is near Auschwitz, the famous death camp. It is a municipality in the Görlitz region of Saxony in Germany, near the border with Poland.
Right.
And its name comes from, oh goodness, we're already into the accents and terrible English people not being able to speak other languages part of the podcast.
Well,
it comes from the Upper Sorbian Krusswa, meaning pear, in 1400, okay. Which explains why its coat of arms is three pears on top of an anvil.
Oh, okay.
It's quite a short article. It's a very recent thing. It's a municipality that was formed by merging several villages in 1994.
Okay.
So it's quite modern, not much history. And it's basically just got a picture, coat of arms, location, and oh, how many people live there? 3,500 people live there.
Okay. So not a colossal amount, but enough.
Yeah, it looks like quite a nice place, actually. The parish church there is a very charming... like Eastern European, imagine like white walls and then you have like black woodwork on the outside.
Right.
And then there's like a tiled roof and a very little wee spire.
Okay.
It looks just like the kind of image you'd imagine, the kind of village in like Warhammer, like in the Empire.
Yeah.
Like imagine that.
Well, it's interesting you should say Warhammer because, well, as you will have remembered a couple of days ago it'll be a week ago now, when my parents came down, they brought down two packs of Warhammer, most of which are intact. So we have so much to do, obviously, when you've finished your PhD. And
this really excites me. Well, we were both into Warhammer as a kid.
Mm.
You were into Warhammer Fantasy, and I was into Warhammer 40,000.
Fantasy is always has always been my thing, and sci-fi has kind of always been yours. So were you Space Marines, I think? And I had Dark Elves and the... Battle for Skull Pass, which were orcs and dwarves, I think.
It was dwarves and goblins, yeah. I was Space Marines. I had my own chapter called the Redemptionists, and I also dabbled with a bunch of Plague Marines. And because the reason I stopped was basically because I went to uni, I didn't have time anymore.
Mm.
I really wanted to start an Imperial Guard regiment. Funnily enough, a very Eastern European inspired Imperial Guard regiment of like for veterans from a world. Where it was like really industrial and there were like oil derricks everywhere and the world had been ravaged. And then they'd taken these veterans and put them in with a bunch of like new recruits from another planet that were like, so you had this really grizzled core and then loads of conscripts that didn't have a clue what they were doing.
See, you actually played, didn't you? You'd played games.
A bit, yeah. I was more of a painter than a gamer, but yeah, I did every aspect of it.
Yeah, so see, I had played games, but I'd only ever really play them when I'd go into an actual games workshop. Near in a kind of a fairly large mall, I guess you'd call it, in Australia where I lived. And I'd go in there, paint for most of the day, and then towards the end, someone would come over and be like, do you want to play a game? And it was more less playing and more teaching me how to play, because I only ever really did it just to paint, you know. I enjoyed it, I found it quite cathartic, and still do.
It's a great community thing, actually, when you're in the shops. Because I used to do that. I used to go in and, like, you'd spend the whole day there. You get, like, a burger or something from nearby. And I used to go with my mate John, who you've met. And we go in and we went. I never actually painted in the store, but we kind of just go in and chill. And then, you know, you do a couple of games because they'd have these battle boards that would be, like, ancient, you know, cityscapes and stuff that you couldn't do on your own.
Yeah.
Although, my favorite thing about the hobby was always doing campaigns. We only really did it because did you ever play the Lord of the Rings strategy battle game?
No.
Because that was basically Warhammer, but instead of having big blocks of units, you had individual soldiers.
Right.
And it was all Lord of the Rings based.
Okay.
And so, like, I had an army of Uruk-hai and I had a Gondorian army.
Mm.
And there was actually, I got it all basically from magazines that they used to come out every week with a model with it. And you just patiently kind of built them up.
See, I had a similar thing in one of those kind of subscription-based magazines. It was originally, now I always forget the name of it. What was the science spin-off of Horrible Histories? Was it Horrible Science?
I'm pretty sure it's Horrible Science.
They did a series of magazines and they were, I think every month, because they were quite substantial things and you got like there was a big kind of physical object that you get as part of the magazines too. I remember having those, and in the final edition, I got a microscope, which was super cool.
Wow.
That was amazing. And they came with some, you know, pre-made slides and then other slides where you could make your own, which was, I fucking loved. And then when I was living in the Netherlands, in The Hague specifically is where we lived, or rather just outside it, there was a Harry Potter magazine, which conveniently was entirely in Dutch. So I never really read it. But it was part of a set where you'd be building the chessboard.
Oh, that's so cool.
So you'd have, yeah. And I remember I had every single piece with the exception of one corner. So it was never finished. But I had all the pieces and you had, you know, it was basically a scaled down replica of the chess set in the first film. And each, you know, each one you had one of the weeks you'd get two wands that you'd use to push the pieces because they were repelling magnets.
Oh,
so you could
move
them forward and back. And the larger pieces had, they'd either light up or the pawns were, if you touched them a certain way with the wand, they'd actually, there was a little kind of trigger inside and they'd explode. Like they'd go into two like they do in the books. And
yeah,
it was really, really good.
I mean, it must have been presumably for however many, 16 weeks, however many pawns there are. You must have just been like, oh, it's another pawn.
Yeah.
Didn't see this coming.
Yeah. They were also very, very clever in what they did. And I remember they didn't give out every piece in one go. So one of the final pieces that you'd get would be like the last white pawn you needed to complete the set, which made you keep buying them until, you know, because if they released the board and the pieces, you could probably get away with not getting the other corners. But in each corner, it was a different house crest that would light up. It was really good.
Because there are various variants of chess that I wasn't aware of. Because, I mean, I used to play chess a little bit against my dad, but he always used to beat me because he's quite clever and knows how to play, whereas I never did. So I kind of never really got into it. But I was researching something about 2001, which is a film I think you've seen.
Mm-hmm. That's a funny joke there. Sorry, can we just take a moment to laugh at Simon's joke?
It's a comeback to a reference. That's an episode that hasn't come out yet and won't come out for a few weeks. Ugh. Where we were playing Kerbal Space Program.
So frustrating.
But yeah, like I was researching the chess game in it, I think, or it was something from like that. I got onto the fact there are variants of chess such as where you have four players,
right,
and there are two games that go on simultaneously, and when a piece is taken from one board, it gets put on the other board.
Yeah,
like there are loads of really cool kind of variants of it, because obviously there's like timed chess and there's boxing chess and like kind of crazy variants, but then there are ones that are just like quite subtle like that, and like team-based chess.
The only other variant of chess that I'm aware of is like 3D chess, from the ones that they play in, because it's Star Trek and that's why they have them in Big Bang Theory, I think, which will be the last time that show is ever mentioned on this podcast, I promise.
Because it's awful. And because if you like it, you have bad taste in comedy.
Awful, yeah. I'd love to try and play it, though.
Episode. Well, there was one that they invented for a campaign with Stephen Hawking and I think it was Paul Rudd or someone, where they had quantum chess. You basically, by moving a piece, you might collapse the wave function of another piece. So there's like a 50% chance that it'll be in one place and a 50% chance it'll be in another place. But I don't know if that was ever developed into a full sport. It was definitely in an advert.
Yeah.
But I thought that was pretty cool. So going back to the Lord of the Rings game, because me and my friends, there was a few of us that played, and we used to do a campaign where you had like each battle, the outcome would affect the soldiers in it that you took into the next thing. So it was almost like having a gang or something. And like if you were wounded, you'd miss a game, and like depending on, you could die from a wound, or you could like develop a vengeance towards somebody. Like if you saw the person on the battlefield that wounded you last time, you had to run at them.
Or
you could lose a finger and you'd have like a detriment to your weapon skill. It was really cool.
Yeah.
And it's definitely something that when I have a bit more time, I want to get into the painting. I love the painting, but like the gaming is something that, although the rules have now completely changed, but I definitely want to get back into it.
Yeah, I remember seeing it in the shop, like people playing it in the store. I just never did it myself.
But now we have all the stuff in. Hopefully when I finish, we'll have a little bit of time before I move out, and we can just go on a bender painting Warhammer all day. And honestly, that thought keeps me going at the moment. It's like the promised lands, the grey havens even. That's just keeping me going.
It was just funny looking back in, other than the two sets that my folks brought down, there were also, was my original kind of like black case that I think you know you said you had as well. And just looking back at these old, you know, the painting was all right, but I would have been gosh, I don't know, 13 or 14. And I hadn't really done it. So, you know, every now and then I'd pick them up. Or I remember my grandpa dug out these old tin soldiers, like, you know, that would have been a set from like Cowboys and Indians or something. So they were pretty old things. And he knows that I was doing Warhammer, and he would say like, oh, can you like repaint them? So I remember just getting some, you know, like of the base kind of primary colors that they would have had at the time, and then just touching them up a bit. And that was quite fun. But it's weird to kind of, it gives you an exact image of how skilled you actually were. I remember painting them being like, oh, these are quite good. And then obviously now looking back, and it would, you know, it's been about, you know, 7 or 8 years. I'm like, these are a bit shit, actually.
Yeah, I remember at the time thinking that, but weirdly, I felt like my painting skills stayed about the same level. Like to me, they always looked about the same. But then when you look back, it was like, Jesus Christ, you were really terrible to begin with. Like the face is just a blob of pink. And, you know, by the end, I was at, you know, doing lips and like eyes and stuff like that.
I think, to be honest, I'd be massively up for doing these again. To be, you know, to get back into painting. The obvious problem was, it was and still is so expensive.
Yeah,
to maintain the hobby, it's ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly insanely expensive, and I feel like that's the point. It's particularly expensive if you're gaming because you need so many miniatures. Whereas for painting, what I think I'd do is buy one miniature that was like just one that I've, regardless of the army, that I just really liked, and then just go to town painting it. If you're interested in this, by the way, readers, I'd recommend that you Google like Slayer sword winners, because there's painting championships that are run in each country, and they're called the Golden Demons, and the winner of each particular tournament gets the Slayer sword, and some of the stuff for it is absolutely insane what people do. You know, I mean, the picture I just sent down was of a Tech Marine that I entered 1 year into the youth category, and I think I spent about 40 or 50 hours on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, people must spend hundreds and hundreds of hours, because some people will sculpt their own models as well. Like,
it's, and you do, the longer you are painting and the more skilled you get, you realize that to really set your models apart from other things is finding those little ways to touch things up. So I remember there was a specific moment where I really understood the benefits of washes, especially, you know, probably even more so in fantasy stuff than in 40k that you did, because chainmail.
Yeah.
To make chainmail look good, I used to try and basically kind of dry brush it rather than that. Rather, if it was too wet, then they would settle into
the holes.
Yeah,
that's the technique I'd use. Yeah.
Yeah. But then I found that, you know, like if you could still just paint it fairly well and then just wash it at the end, and it would just instantly look so much better.
Yeah. If you did like a bulk gun metal dry brush on it, let it dry, and then do like a black ink, watered down black ink, and then maybe stipple, like, I don't know. That was the other thing, is the paints had the best names.
Yeah. Well, Mithril Silver was my favorite.
I wonder if, hang on, can I get this, if I find like the Games Workshop paint range, because Dad will sometimes still use paints that I bought for like stuff around the house, because he worked out that the wall around the edge of the house, around a bit of the garden, is bleached bone. Like, it's exactly bleached bone. So if he needs to touch anything up, he just gets the little tiny pot of paint.
Amazing.
But like, I think they've changed all the name of the paints.
I'm just
googling the Citadel painting system. That was it. Oh yeah, here we go. Like Mephiston Red, Screamer Pink, the Fang. It's just one of them. That's a reference to the Space Wolves, of course. That's the other thing, is like Dan's big thing in terms of lore is World of Warcraft. It's fair to say.
Oh, here we go. I thought I could get away with never telling anyone. This is my shame.
We'll get on to that, but like Dan's big thing is World of Warcraft lore. My big thing is very much Warhammer 40,000 lore. Like I'm looking through these names, and I know basically every name is a reference to.
Yeah.
Because I've read literally dozens of books about 40,000.
It's the same with World of War in the Warcraft universe. There's history that literally spans hundreds of thousands of years before the MMORPG, the World of Warcraft game, happens. And that was starting with the original Warcraft games, but they were all released as novels. I don't know really what it was, because I think I would have been in year 5 or year 6 in the Netherlands, and I had a friend of mine in my class, and his elder brother played, and I remember going over to his house once and seeing this game. And this was back in, you know, the game hadn't been released for very long. It would may have been out for about a year, maybe two. Right. It's just vanilla World of Warcraft before any of the expansions, and it all gets crazy and timelines start to go to shit. And, but I remember seeing this thing, and I get this, and I think you'll understand the feeling when I give you my kind of the way to quantify it for you. It's like watching the original, the first kind of survival nights that the Yogscast ever did for Minecraft.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you remember those? And it just has, and you can still watch those videos now, and it has the most bizarre kind of, you feel, you are transported back to that time when you were watching it for the first time. And this it's like a physical change happens in your body. You can, you know, it's really, really interesting. Obviously, I'm now super cool and a fun guy to be around, so I don't play anymore. Much to my sadness.
When Legion came out, you just vanished for like 3 days. How much time did you sink into Legion?
Pretty much 3 days.
Like straight.
I sent you that photo that you've still got. Remember of me in with the comically large headphones, being like, "I've done a bad thing," yeah. And it's just me grinning. It was good. I mean, it's no surprise to anyone that we're both massively dorky people, but. It is. It's really nice to have something that, yes, it's a bit lame when you look back, but for that time
but
in your childhood.
I don't know if it is lame. I mean, at the end of the day, it's just us being really passionately interested in something. I don't know why that should ever be a bad thing.
It's No. It's not lame in that sense. I think it can be perceived as, certainly from a video games perspective, but I suppose it's also like people who are really, really invested in musicals or TV or books, in that the argument can be made that how much time did you spend shut away inside, investing yourself into a piece of fiction when you could have been outside doing other things. So in that sense, I think it can be criticized. But equally, it was so important for me, for like the community around it and the thing, you know, like I wouldn't trade it for the world.
But this annoys me, like, because people say, oh, you could be going outside and doing other things. And it's like, what makes those things more worthwhile? Like,
it's probably healthier for one thing, like,
but it's healthy in the sense of, like, you know, from a social perspective, you made friends doing it, I made friends doing it, it developed friendship, like John is like one of my best friends, you know, we got to know each other through this stuff. You know, it's hugely healthy in that sense. It's because there's this thing in society where it's like, oh, if you do sports, that's a healthy thing to do. And not just in terms of, like, physically, obviously, you know, doing sport is healthier than painting miniatures. But I feel like if you were painting a canvas or something, like if you were actually going down a traditional art route, then people wouldn't take such an issue with it. It's just like there's a kind of stigma against these kind of activities where it's I think maybe the thing is it's detail rich. Like,
yeah, well, it's, I think, you know, it was Hank Green who very kind of aptly described his kind of joy in being called a nerd and a geek, because that word doesn't work as an insult, because all it is, it's describing someone who is incredibly passionate about a specific thing. That's really great. I think that's to be encouraged, for sure. I'm not saying that those things are, you know, of course I'm not saying that, because I did them for most of my childhood. But you can't, you know, there's arguments to be made on both sides. The arguments exist, I think, because they're from two vastly different worlds, and to try and find some common ground between the two is probably very difficult.
But it's the primacy of one. It's the primacy of, like, the more traditional, sporty, you know, cooler, you could say.
I think that's things. It's that. I mean, I think it's manifested itself like that because. If you think about the culture, the two separate cultures that are involved in, you know, sporty, physical, academic-y things, and the slightly more kind of tame, I'm going to use the word geeky and nerdy again, kind of things. One very much works for an extroverted person, the other works for an introvert. So naturally, the conversations that are going to happen between the two are going to be one-sided on the side of the extrovert. It's only, I think, now with the kind of, in the age of the internet, where people can talk more than we've got, like, you know.
But also,
this,
like,
can we just take a moment to get metaphysical here and step out of this conversation we're having to have another conversation? This might be the deepest conversation we've ever had.
What, in the podcast or ever, just generally?
I think this is this in the history of humankind. No, in the podcast, it's just, you know.
It's pretty heavy stuff, but this matters, and I think because we're both people that have been on the receiving end of this stuff.
Well,
we are both people. It's like that time in a video when I was like, "This is a book," and then I paused for like a little bit too long, and it was just like, "Yeah, well done, Simon."
Yeah,
you know, we're both people that have been on the receiving end of this kind of judgment of people being like, "Oh, you know, you're geeky, you're nerdy." It's just why are you wasting your time with that stuff? And I'm not saying that, like, it's the classic thing that, like, your parents might say. I don't think my parents ever said that to me. I think my dad got it because he was into Tolkien when he was a kid, and he painted, like, model planes with me and stuff like that. But, like, I felt like we've both been judged for doing something that we've gotten really into, but people who are really into football and might be really detail-oriented and being like, oh, this player's going to transfer from this club this season, but the window's closing soon, so, you know, if this manager doesn't get their act together. It's like, people like that are, like, generally regarded, you know, it's, like, accepted in society. And it just really irks me that, because I would never shirk away from this stuff. I'd be very, you know, I think some people think it's embarrassing, including, like, Pixel Girl, would think it's embarrassing for me to talk about how much I like learning about Warhammer, and you know, if I'd love to have the time to get back into playing and painting it. I'm never going to apologize for that, because why should I? Why does this activity have anything you know, any less worth to it?
Yeah, no, I also think too that we're fortunate in being able to express our opinions kind of very boldly now, because we're at an age where if someone's going to come up to me now, a, you know, 20-year-old, and be like, oh, you're interested in Warhammer, that's a bit lame, isn't it? I'm already just going to be like, well, I mean, I guess it kind of is, but I love it, so I can disregard that.
You cast Fireball.
Yeah, it's more damaging when you're, you know, a child at school, and that, you know, that's when it can either turn you off. It makes or breaks you, basically, doesn't it? You can either say, right, I'm going to claim this as my own, and in a way that can almost be equally as dangerous as shunning it, because you then kind of lock yourself away into friends that you just have. And so it can be incredibly isolating. But equally, I'm sure this is an issue that, you know, is similar for people who say that you're really, really good at sport. And you really don't click academically at school, then it's exactly the same thing. You just you shy away from that. You might, you know, someone might be really, really interested in a niche area of, I don't know, history or something, but they haven't had an opportunity to do it again. And it's that make or break stage in early education where you're kind of segregated, I suppose.
Like, I just remember the overarching attitude in my school, and by this I mean, in primary school, interestingly, it wasn't really a problem, but in secondary school, it was like, hey, why are you trying? Like, why are you putting so much effort in? God. And it's like, since when did trying become uncool? Like, surely the people that try and are willing to put work in are the people that should be respected the most. And it's the people, in my school certainly, it was the people that just didn't try and were just like, yeah, whatever. They were the cool kids. And I've never understood that. And that's something, when I have kids, I think it's very important to drill, not drill into your kids, that sounds very military, but, like, to impress on them that, you know, what's the point of being alive if you're not going to try at stuff?
Yeah, I think it's most important just for openness, rather than necessarily saying put 110% into everything you do and always, you know, always leap at new things, and which is obviously very important. I think it's a far more applicable life skill for just people to be like, you know what, just, you've got your own head on your shoulders there. You do what's right, especially as we keep talking about these early stages, and see how it works out for you. You know, a child will learn more of a lesson by making the mistakes and feeling bad about it than, you know.
Yeah.
This is at this point that we should announce to the readers. The reason we're talking about this a lot is because Simon and I are going to adopt a child. we've been giving this a lot of thought. We think we're ready. Obviously, we've got a PhD student who's nearly done. I'm dropping out of university and I'm going to just take up a job in manual labor so I can be the chief breadwinner of the household.
I'm carrying the child.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, we spoke about this.
Oh, did we?
You're going to be the surrogate mother. He or she is going to call you mum. because I'm naturally the more masculine figure in this relationship.
Yeah, as all the fan fiction clearly shows. Yeah.
Oh, for God's sake.
Actually, I did, just to go back to the whole geeky point, by the way, and this is very much trying to lighten the tone still. The next level up that we never got to and we've been learning about recently is LARPing.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd be really curious to know if any readers of the podcast do LARPing.
So LARPing, for those who don't know, live action role play.
Yeah,
Which isn't a kinky thing. It can be, but it's typically a medieval setting, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, it's basically Dungeons and Dragons.
Sorry, take what?
sorry, I had a stroke in the middle of a sentence
yeah.
then.
No, go
if
on,
you
try
take
again.
Dungeons and Dragons, which if you've seen Stranger Things or Community or I've been in other stuff too, it's like a fantasy role playing, basically. It's basically that, but you actually physically act out what your character's doing, and you go to these big meetups. So we follow these guys on YouTube called Hat Films, and two of them do LARPing with a friend of theirs, and they make videos just sort of basically describing what they get up to on a weekend. And it's we were watching this hour-long video and we thought it sounded really cool, and it's not something I've ever done or I've ever seriously considered doing, but I'd love
likewise.
To hear from any readers that do it, because yeah, it sounds really fun.
I think it would be, it's definitely something I'd want to try. I think for the first couple of times I'd go, I'd be really self-conscious.
Oh yeah.
Cuz you know, you've got to let your guard down, and as we've already established, we've grown up into a society that typically kind of is really overly harsh with anything that is remotely dorky or niche. And you've just got to obviously there's going to be a difference with you being surrounded by people who are accepting and encouraging of that.
It must be a very healthy environment for it, I think. I mean, obviously it's dangerous if it, like you said before, if it allows you to become very isolated. But I feel like if it's over a weekend, that can only be a healthy thing, right?
Yeah.
To really embody your geeky side.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it would be good. It's definitely something we'll have to try.
I wonder if there, because I certainly have only ever heard of LARPing in a fantasy setting. I don't know if there's like sci-fi LARPing, because you do sometimes hear of like zombie events where you know, you get it's like over a night. I remember one happened in Belfast a couple of years ago, and you basically just try and survive, and you get people who are either volunteers or actors who are zombies and will track you down.
Yeah.
Which I'd never do. That sounds terrifying.
You were saying your dad was into Lord of the Rings.
Very, yeah.
Yeah. Where do you think the seed for sci-fi, or less where actually and more when, do you think the seed for sci-fi was planted in your mind? Because if I think about where fantasy started for me, it would without a doubt be Harry Potter.
Mm.
That was my first taste of magic, if you like. And then ever since then, I've always been interested. You know, I was talking to you the other day about, I recently met a girl at a party and she was recommending me the book, the...
Oh, you got this name wrong twice yesterday, so take your time.
Yeah. Now, I think it's the... Was it The Voice of the Wind?
Something like that. It was something very poetic.
It was either that or something like The Smell of the Woods or something like that. I don't know. But she was absolutely raving about it. And it's won a load of... here's a segue. It was that... it won that really weird award.
Oh, the Man Asia Prize or something like that?
The Man
Asian
Man
Prize?
Yeah. But apparently it's, you know, it's got really, really good reviews. So as soon as I finish... I'm currently reading the first in the Red Mars...
Yeah, which
trilogy.
I want to read as well. I've been meaning to read it for a long time.
It's really, really well done. And it's the first sci-fi book I've ever read. I've typically only ever been, you know, I obviously prefer fiction over non-fiction 9 times out of 10. But it's always been typically from a more fantasy setting. And the science holds up too. One of the big kind of why it's so critically acclaimed is because the science that they talk about makes sense. It's checked by physicists and it is very plausible.
The Martian's very good in that sense as well.
I haven't read that.
We were talking about that earlier today, funnily enough. But yeah, the book's excellent. If you're a geek, I highly recommend reading it. So to go back to your question about sci-fi, I'm pretty sure it would have been 1997 when Mum bought home the box set of...
The year 1997, I thought you'd say. I'm pretty sure when you were born.
I sensed the disturbance in the force.
Yeah.
It was when Mum came home. This was when my dad was away at sea for however many months it was at a time. In the Navy, she came home with the box set of the original Star Wars trilogy, but the special editions that were released in 1997. And I remember we watched one a night for 3 nights, and I'm pretty sure it was just from then on I was just like, yeah, I'm totally, totally into Star Wars and more generally sci-fi. Because I think up until then, I mean, yeah, that was the same year that Harry Potter came out, wasn't it, actually? 97? I think that was when the first book came out.
I think so, yeah.
So I think I remember reading them very soon after they came out, and I was at an age where my first question to Mum was, does it have pictures? And she gave me the book to read. And I think it was the first proper like book I read without pictures on my own. Yeah, I guess before then, I don't really remember anything that particularly sticks in my mind to do with sci-fi. I was kind of a probably a more fantasy-based kid, I guess. But then again, the big genres of fantasy at the moment are like Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Game of Thrones, you could argue. And all of these were not a thing when I was a kid. Like, the Lord of the Rings film started coming out in 2001, and I was really skeptical. I remember we got the VHS of the first one, and I saw on the back there was, like, the Fellowship in Moria. And I was just like, oh, they're going to get out of this situation with their magical powers. And I was like, well, I'll watch it anyway. And then 3.5 hours later, I was like, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah. I had a friend who was really into when in primary school. So I would this would have been year three or four, that young. And he was obsessed with Legolas. Like, whenever we played outside, he would always be. And he kind of looked a bit like an elf. He had blonde hair, blue eyes, and, like, he was quite tall. Whereas I resembled more of a kind of a hobbit, I guess. Yeah, he was super into it. And I think it was him talking about the films that caused me to watch them. I mentioned them to my mum, and I think we got the videos out from the library or something, and watched them, and yeah.
Do you think that you would have, if you hadn't watched them at that time in your life, do you think you would have always have gone into fantasy stuff? Or was that, like, there was a very specific inroad for you?
I think it's more in line with my way of looking at the world.
Fantasy.
Yeah, no, but, like, as a, you know, I'm not as a logical person. I'm an emotional person.
Yeah,
and that's more in line with fantasy. And also, you know, for someone who's always been interested in English literature, which is why I'm studying it, the language of fantasy is that kind of archaic. You know, you can't help but imagine picking up a fantasy book and having to kind of blow the dust off the spine and pick away the cobwebs. And it's that slightly almost overly romanticized view that I really, really like. Having said that, the sci-fi I'm reading is tremendous, and it's a different style, and I really enjoy it. But there's something romantic about fantasy that is it's right up my Straße.
I suppose, right up your Straße. I suppose the thing with sci-fi is that it is always very logic based, but then there's different kinds of sci-fi, right? There's the difference between people who are Star Trek like fans and people who are Star Wars fans. Like, Star Wars was always very hand wavy when it came to there isn't really any science in Star Wars. That's very emotional, like mythic kind of thing.
What do you mean, midichlorians, Simon?
Now don't even start, mate. Do not even start. Like, whereas Star Trek was always very, you know, like, science based. Like, the fact they even went into the explanation of how the warp drive works, and it's like antimatter-matter collisions fueled by dilithium crystals, and then there's, like, technical papers on it, and it's like they never get that with Star Wars. And I feel like there's different kinds of nerd within the sci-fi genre, and I think Warhammer is more the emotive side of things. It's not so much logical, because the whole thing with Warhammer 40,000 is that logic is dead, and, like, the gods are real, and there's slaughter on scales unimaginable, and it's just a question of surviving. And I feel like that's like more appealing to me than something like, for example, Ian M. Banks, which I've read reading his culture novel series with Consider Phlebas. It'd be interesting to see what you make of it after Red Mars, because that's very logic based. It feels very sciencey science fiction, and I found that quite intimidating to read compared to a lot of the science fiction I'd read before. But then I also loved The Martian. So it's like, maybe it was just the writing style. I don't know. I need to read more sci-fi.
I suppose you've got to try and, as a writer, unless you're really writing for a niche audience, it's being able to find a balance between the two.
Yeah.
And kind of find that happy medium where it's not too intense, but it's intense enough and accurate enough that it's believable. So it's, you know, again, it's like writing any piece of fiction and finding where the sweet spot of the suspension of disbelief works. If you don't get there, you're not invested. If you overkill it, you become hyper aware of it, and then equally you're not invested. So there's this little kind of gap, isn't there?
Well, we start seeing the like, kind of the bleeding of the two genres into each other. In I think you could argue that Game of Thrones is a bit like that, actually, and that there is fantasy elements to it. There's dragons, there's zombies and stuff like that. But at the same time, it's basically a political intrigue thriller for the first couple of books. The prime example within sci-fi would be, you know, there's that film with Will Smith that's coming out, Bright, the Netflix one.
Oh, the Netflix, yeah.
And it's like a crime drama, but it's in a fantasy world. And I feels like that's like where sci-fi is heading, is like trying to connect those two halves of it. Like, I suppose what J.J. Abrams did with Star Trek, in that, like, he kind of made it
It's also,
motive.
That new Netflix original is kind of putting off a similar vibe, but they're going to do it infinitely better than, is it the Dark Tower films that are coming out soon?
Oh, yeah.
It's that similar, it's that crossover between, and, you know, I'm still going to see it, of course, and I'd hope that it works, but it's hard not to be overly critical when you're watching the trailers and you're already a bit like, oh gosh, this might flop. I'm not sure, you know.
Yeah, and it's such a, because Matthew McConaughey is so great, and Idris Elba is one of my favourite actors. I fucking love Idris Elba. And obviously, like, the story's good, and I've been told to read the book several times. I don't actually think the film's an adaptation of the books. I think it's like set after the books, maybe. So I don't think it spoils it, basically. So I will get around to reading that, but like, it definitely feels like it's not gonna do well. Like, although to go sort of back to literature, because you know they're making that adaptation of His Dark Materials, like a Game of Thrones style adaptation. Now that, if they do it well, will be phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like I'm the His Dark Materials is, that's one of Dad's favorite books, actually. I remember as a kid, both parents read it after me.
Yeah. They were meant to also be doing an adaptation of the Red Mars trilogy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was reading the Wikipedia page, I think a week ago or something, and I think for whatever reason, administrative causes have meant that it's been held up and it will be postponed until a later date. But people are keen for it, and that could be interesting, cool. You know.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it'll certainly be better than that new. Now, what is it? It's on Fox, isn't it? And I'm talking about the sci-fi, basically piss take with Seth MacFarlane.
Oh God, it's like a Star Trek piss take. It just watch Galaxy Quest, guys. It does it so much better. Like,
yeah, Alan Rickman, right?
Yeah. Oh, bless him. And it's a very good. Have you not seen it though?
No.
No, you should. You'd love it. It's very, very good.
Yeah, anything with him in, I'm sure. I remember, can you remember when we walked out of the screening of
Eye in the Sky?
My God, and so that was his last on-screen credit before he passed away. Yeah. But what a heavy film. I remember watching it with...
Chloe, my friend Chloe.
Yeah, and we all just came out like properly chilled to the bone and just, you know, it's a very,
if you
very
haven't
moving,
seen the film,
moving piece of work.
Dear readers, you absolutely should see it, and like, it's one to watch. You can't be like on your phone half out of the film. You've got to be fully invested, because it hits you like a emotional sledgehammer to the face.
Yeah,
it's really heavy. Whew. God, that was quite deep. Not the first time I've said that to you. Shall we go to Correspondence Corner?
let's go there.
So as always, guys, we've had actually an abnormally large number of emails this week, so we do apologize if yours doesn't get read out. We do read every single one, and we reply when we can. Obviously I'm a bit busy at the moment, but we're very appreciative to everybody who writes in. We love reading your emails.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Starting off with Jay Wright has written, Dear Messrs. Moore and Clark, got the order wrong, but okay. Words cannot express how excited I was this morning when I saw there was a new vlog. I was more excited than a six-year-old on Christmas morning. In fact, I was so happy that I finally decided to become a Patreon supporter of yours, Simon. You're the first and so far only creator I support on Patreon, so go you. Thank you very much. Patreon does make a huge difference. We will be setting one up for the podcast eventually, because it does cost us $9 a month, I think it is, to host. And we figured there's probably going to be 9 people in the audience who'd be willing to donate $1 a month. That's literally all we're looking for. We just want to cover our costs.
Yeah.
But thank you very much, Jay. And I love putting the vlog out, actually. I thought it was quite a good one this week.
I enjoyed it.
It's been a long time since I put one out, so it was.
That's
really,
the thing.
Really,
I remember saying to you when you came home, I started watching the beginning, and it made me realize how long ago some of that footage was.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't remember doing this. I'm like, oh, you know, I do. It was like a month ago.
So there's another one in the can, and then I'm doing one this week. And the start of the next one is going to be Corin needing the toilet. If you remember that escapade we were on.
Oh, I do. Yeah, that was from Trouserless Truro.
Yeah, Trouserless Truro. Or Pantsless Penryn, for some people. Anyway, just wanted to go back to Jay's email. Just wanted to express my support to you both. Good luck with the rest of your PhD, Simon. Thank you very much. Also, he says, before I go, I have one last question. How tall are you, Dan? Is Simon just ungodly tall, or are you really that short?
I think I'm like 5'9".
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, because you're not that much taller than Pixel Girl, and she's 5'7", I think.
Okay, maybe 5'8".
So I think you might be 5'8", and I'm 6'1". Yeah. So there's a fair gap between us.
Yeah.
But I'm not like, once I made a video, it was my Ice Bucket Challenge, which is still on my channel if you want to see me in a see-through white t-shirt, but my friend Sam gave me a hand, and Sam is like 6'5", and he was standing on a ledge, and he was like, you know, doused me in it, whatever. And somebody commented, being like, making a comment about his height, and he was like, wow, Simon's really short. And then Sam replied saying, it's like, yeah, he's absolutely tiny, you know. And then somebody else replied to him saying, no, I think you'll find that Simon's actually about 6'1". You just got this wrong. And he was like, I'm in the video. I was the one doing it. We next have a follow-up email from Sue Hale, which you might remember from last time, basically saying that he has got in. So,
oh, super.
Congrats, Sue Hale.
Congratulations, Sue Hale.
Just a round of applause. Great job. To everybody who got into your universities of choice, top lads. And for those of you that did not, it is absolutely not the end of the world. Remember, my first choice to do a PhD was an Exeter, and I am happier here than I've ever been. So
it should be also said, too, that pursuing academia is definitely not for everyone, and there's an outstanding number of people who just, you know, did what they wanted to do in other paths and have done incredibly well out of it. So I feel like, especially now, it's almost expected that you go to university. And for, I think, a lot of people, they would come out and say, I don't really think this was a good use of my time. So
yeah, there was a foundation I was involved in called Edge, actually, that did a lot of stuff to do, specifically vocational qualifications, which are definitely underrated. Like, loads of people go to uni that should be doing vocational stuff, so don't feel pressured, guys. It's not the only route.
Exactly. The next email is from Bradley Dean. It's titled University Love and More. Dear Simon and Dan, first of all, I'd like to say that I've been a long-time reader of both the Wikicast and Simon's YouTube channel. I thoroughly enjoy everything and love your friendship. I've just received my A-level results and sadly didn't manage to get into the University of Manchester, my first choice, but luckily I managed to secure a place at Keele University, studying the same course, which is in neuroscience.
Oh, congratulations.
God, well done. Do either of you have any tips for beginning university, both in terms of moving to halls and surviving on your own, and tips for organisation and note-taking in lectures? I'd also love it if you had some romantic advice for a fella lost in love. Oh, mate, I've got you covered, don't worry.
Yeah, Dan is a noted authority.
I've been with my girlfriend for a couple of months, and things have moved on quickly into a loving relationship. We both see each other very much, but I'm worried that university will take its toll on our relationship. Well, this is something that Simon will be able to chip in on. Any thoughts? Keep up the good work, because you're definitely onto a winning formula, lads. I love you and wish you both well. P.S. I definitely need more of Dan's forehead in my life, and dogs all the way. Thank you, Bradley. That's good to know.
You were good up until the end then. If you'd like more of Dan's forehead in your life, there is a fan account on Twitter, as I pointed out to you. It's like at Dan's forehead or something. It's amazing. Shall we work from the top down then? Advice for moving into halls and surviving on your own, general freshers stuff. You're close to this, Dan, so you can start.
I think it depends on what kind of halls you're in. I was very much like, I had a corridor of people that I didn't really ever talk to, and just mainly used my room as somewhere to work and somewhere to sleep. I kind of fell in love with the chapel choir group, and that was the whoever I ever did any kind of socializing with, we'd usually be either in the chapel or going away. So I'd say equally try and make friends with folks in your halls, because you'll see them very regularly, but equally don't feel bad if they're not your primary source of kind of socializing, because, you know, you'll be greeted with societies, and if you do music, lots of music stuff, and course mates as well. I didn't have any friends on my course who lived in my block in halls, really. So don't stress too much.
I think it's a very common thing to not have your closest group of friends to be from your halls. I think it's much better to, because that's basically just chance. It's pure chance. You might end up with some great friends, you know, and lots of people do. But I think there's a reason why people tend to flock to either course mates or people from societies, because you have something in common, you know, like with us with chapel choir, we became friends because we both like music and we're both geeky. But, you know, basically I wouldn't, don't feel obliged to be super close friends. Obviously try and make friends, and it's good, very good to like socialize with them, especially to begin with, just so you have a bit of a safety net, and you're all in it together. That's the other thing, everyone's in the same situation, so you're all wanting to kind of get along, but don't feel like that's the only way you're going to make friends. I'd really encourage you, once you get to uni, to go to the Freshers Fair and sign up to stuff you're interested in. Go to taster events, get yourself out there.
And that's another thing. I feel like certainly on at Exeter University, it's Freshers Fair, and that can be, in my first year, I didn't really do a great deal. But obviously in second year, I had to represent, you know, the chapel stall on quite a few of the days. And the number of things that you just don't know what's happening on the uni if you don't really spend some time and really take the day to learn about what's going on culturally on campus. It's a really good use of time. So, and
I'm sure, is completely overwhelming. Like, the best way I can think to describe it is, and this is more the case at Oxford, was if you remember those tower defense games like Bloons, and you'd have like a course and stuff would go along it. If being a fresher feels like being a balloon in Bloons, because you've just got people throwing like concepts at you and ideas and trying to get you to sign up. And especially as a musician, if you went, because in Oxford they divided up the exam scores into like different zones. There was like the sports hall and the music hall and the languages hall. And if you find out that you're a musician in the music hall, they were like onto you. It was like hyenas onto a corpse. And yeah, it feels a bit disorienting. That's going to be a wild ride for all you freshers. On the speaking of wild rides, on the love side of things, I'm going to say something which is probably going to be unpopular. From my experience, I don't think that relationships from home, from sixth form, carry on to uni. That's certainly been my personal experience, and it's been the experience of people I've known. My girlfriend at the time, my now ex-girlfriend, agreed with me afterwards that we should have broken up when we went to uni. It would have saved us a lot of grief in terms of like a long distance relationship. Now, of course, that's not saying that everybody should do that, because there are plenty of people that make relationships work all the way through uni. And we know some people that have done that. But it's basically it's a really sucky thing. But I think it sounds very cold to say it holds you back, but it definitely held me back socially. And that was more, I suppose, me than for my girlfriend. But yeah, personally, I don't think it works. And I think it might be the most loving thing to do if you want to avoid causing hurt to the other person, to end the relationship before you go to uni.
No. I think that's probably quite wise. I think it's also worth saying that if you care about something enough and you're willing to make it work, it will work no matter what. It just depends on how much effort you can put in, and how much effort you can put in feasibly.
Have you emotionally distanced yourself from this conversation? You sound like you're further away.
I've just moved my microphone.
Oh, that would be why.
It's other than obviously like a geographical move in going to university, there's a massive emotional and mental move that goes on within the individual. And obviously being in a relationship, there's two individuals to consider there. So, you know, if you're happy now, then I think the most important thing that you can do is just talk. And keep conversations happening, and don't go quiet, because as soon as things do and you're not kind of up to date with each other, then it can make things more complicated, I'd like to say. So just communication. As a prime example of that, you were with Pixel Girl for a year and you were in two different countries.
Yeah, we'd only been dating for about 2 months before as well.
Yeah, so that's proof that it, long distance relationships can work. But equally, you both knew from each other's perspectives how much effort you had to put in. I think if you're willing to make it work and you both care about it enough, then you shouldn't have any issues.
So there, but, you go, no consensus, we're distancing ourselves, so whatever happens, one of us was right.
But I hope whatever happens is the best outcome for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've got one here which is exciting me already, from Sophie Herondale.
Great name.
It's titled Dogs, and she says, Hi, thank you both for the awesome podcast. I love listening to them and laughing along. Here are some reasons why dogs are better than cats. I'm so excited to read this. One, they know when you're sad and try to make you feel better. For example, my dog Maverick, by the way, awesome name for a dog, once sat on my lap and tried to play with me.
Play for me.
When he
tried to play the violin. When he heard you crying, it was like...
yeah. Two, dogs make better friends, for sure. Three, if someone broke into your house, most dogs would try and protect you and raise alarm, whereas most cats would just be like, that's very true. Feel free to disagree with any of these.
I'm going to wait till the end. Don't worry.
For dogs can be trained to do cool things like sniff out bombs, find missing people, and aid people like the disabled and the blind. So they, I guess, other than just being a nice companion, they do actually serve quite an important purpose in society, which is less than can be said to cats. Five, dogs love to run and can be great running partners, which motivates you to keep running for their sake. Sophie Smith, an aspiring astrophysicist.
Aspiring. Oh, I think she means aspiring, not inspiring. Sophie, you're an inspiring astrophysicist. astrophysicists. I mean, look, I get why dogs are great. You don't need to sell me on dogs. I really, really like dogs. I just personally prefer cats. And all of these reasons, well, I'm not going to say all of them, but I basically, the fact that dogs try and make you feel better when you're sad, my cat used to do that to me. Like, it's not just a dog thing. Dogs make better friends. My best friend when I was growing up was a cat.
But I think it's unfair to give specific examples. I think as a whole...
She gave a specific example.
Dogs... No, but I think it would be equally as fair to say that dogs on a whole are more feeling than cats.
Yeah, I think if you're going to take the mean average, that's probably a fair statement. It's been in my experience. I grew up with an amazing cat. And I think if you get a good, friendly cat, there's just nothing like it. Because the thing with cats is that the main reason that I have is that dogs give affection just blindly. Like, you don't really have to earn the affection of a dog. You just have to kind of give it food. And people will say that about cats. Like, if you just, they'll if you give them food, they'll tolerate you. But, like, if a cat likes you, it's decided to like you. And I think that's just worth more than blindly giving love like a dog does. But thank you very much for your email, Sophie. We're going to have to agree to disagree on this one. Please, team cat people, email in. We're losing. Next, we have an email from Natalie Hogg. Dear Simon and Dan, I am writing to say thanks for the brilliant podcast, and to Simon, thanks for your great vlogs. I'm starting my PhD in physics in October, and your vlogging has been an enjoyable insight into PhD life. Well, I'm glad one of us thought it was enjoyable. Congratulations on starting your PhD. You've got a wild ride ahead of you. I'd like to continue in the recommendations vein of the previous weeks and suggest you try listening to Cabin Pressure, a Radio 4 sitcom about a dysfunctional airline crew. I know you're both into visual media, but give it a go, as I think you'll like the humour.
I have listened to Cabin Pressure, and it was recommended to me by a dear, dear friend, and it's incredible. It's really,
really
funny.
I had to give it a go, because I really like Radio 4 sitcoms, actually. They're very good.
No, I think it'll be right up your street.
Well, if it's coming from both you and Natalie, then I'm sold. Thank you. Thank you very much, Natalie. The next email.
Yeah.
The next email is just called Cats Are F***ing Useless.
Truer words were never spoken. That's brilliant, Sam. Well done.
Oh, you can read this one then. Okay.
Hello, Simon and Dan. I've been binge reading your podcast, podcast, nice,
like,
and have just fallen in love, much like you two fall in love with each other in those amazing fan fictions. They're very nice. I've been subscribed to Simon's channel for a while and love the vlogs. You guys really do put on some great content. I bought an electric keyboard earlier this summer. Oh. I didn't buy one. I got given to one because I'm an MD of a society, which has been amazing. But I hope you're enjoying it. It is my first instrument ever, and I'm having some trouble learning how to play and how to read / understand sheet music. Any recommendations for how to learn sheet music and how to learn to play the piano / keyboard? Thanks so much for any response. You two are amazing. I've actually got a load of a folder full of music, kind of certainly from a reading perspective and understanding notation. I've got loads of that because of doing, you know, Exeter University Singers and GNS, and I'm basically putting together a load of documentation to help with people whose sight reading isn't too great. So I will send that to you. I'll send you those documents.
I actually have a book that I bought because basically I've never had piano lessons and I don't know any music theory, but I can play the sax, which means that I can read instrument music, and I can also sing, which means I can read bass clef as well. And so trying to teach myself the piano, what I found is getting an instruction book, and I think I'll send a link for Dan to give you, to the book that I use. It's like step by step, week by week kind of thing. The most important thing, though, is it's all well and good doing that. You've got to practice. It sucks to be told that, but the thing with music, as with so many things in life, is the more work you put in, the more you get out of it. And
yeah,
it's literally just time, unfortunately. It's just doing it every day, just a little bit, even if it's just a minute, just every day. That's how you learn.
There's never a day, certainly from my perspective, in having, you know, we've got the keyboard in the house, I've got a banjo in my room, a ukulele I can see from where I'm sitting, and my guitar, it's the guitar that I pick up most often. And I do make a really concerted effort to pick it up at least once every day. And I think one thing that it's worth touching on is when I was in primary school, I had piano lessons for maybe a year or so. And whether it was just the style in which I was being taught that didn't quite click with me, it was very much theory, theory, theory. Very little to do with actually playing the instrument, which is why I wanted to do it. You know, you've almost got a tremendous advantage in teaching yourself an instrument. I never had lessons with the guitar, and I feel I'm getting pretty competent at it now. And I've been playing for just under 2 years. But when it means that whenever you're picking the instrument up, you're picking it up because you want to play it and you care about it. You're not being told. And as soon as the passion goes, you know, it's almost worth your time taking some time away and waiting until you can fall in love with the instrument again and then pick it up.
To quote the philosopher Bob Ross, when it comes to creative stuff, I completely agree with his perspective, which is that talent is nothing more than a pursued interest. Mm. If you're interested in doing it, pursue it, put the time in, you'll become talented. Next message from Kyle Vaughan. Good day, Mr. and Mrs. Manly Man.
Nice.
I'd like that. I am a student in America entering my second last year of secondary school, and I was wondering what you two were thinking when you were at this stage of life, ending high school and entering college. I'm incredibly nervous for what the future holds and would greatly appreciate any advice you could give. 2 years before leaving school, what were you thinking about, Dan?
2 years before I was leaving school, I was saying goodbye to my family.
Oh, so, gosh, yeah.
Gush, indeed.
Gush.
I sounded the same thing. Yeah, so we've touched on this before, but basically the reason that I've been fortunate enough to live in different countries is because of my dad's work. And one of the, he was offered quite important promotion, and that would have meant leaving Australia and going back to the Netherlands for a while. I was really, really happy at the school I was in Australia. It was the second school, St. Leonard's College, Melbourne. It really clicked with me. It was really, you know, I hadn't been anywhere like it. And certainly the previous school that I was at in Australia really wasn't for me. I had a really, really hard time there. It just wasn't very fun. So I remember going back about, pretty much almost as before the IB course started, I took a trip back with the family to go to the Netherlands to look at prospective schools. And that was really hard because I didn't want to go at all. And we eventually came to the decision that I would leave. And when I was back in Australia, I messaged my closest friends, maybe 7 or 8 of them, and we organized a dinner. And over the dinner, I kind of said, this is happening. I really don't want to go. And one of those friends, her name was Kate, she decided that she was going to go home to her parents that night. And apparently they spoke until the early hours of the morning, basically pitching the idea of me living with them instead. And that's what happened. So it was a hard time, not only thinking about where I was going to be. I just received, or was just about to receive my citizenship. So I was thinking, as far as uni goes, do I want to go to uni in Australia? Mum and dad are in the Netherlands. What about the UK? So it's a troubling time. I think it's very important to keep those things in mind and forward plan, but also don't let them blur what's happening to you in the moment, because your final 2 years of school are very important. And you don't want to think so far ahead that you're not seeing what's happening right in front of you and becoming distant to that. So keep it in mind, but don't stress out too much. Just do the best you can with the time that you've got. And God, it sounds like he's dying. You'll be fine. Don't get too stressed out, and focus on the moment.
I was thinking about sex at the time. Being 17.
That's nice.
That was the main major thing on my mind, I think. Focus on what you're doing in the short term. Especially if that's sex, and don't get too caught up in thinking about the future. Basically, by that point, I decided I knew I was going to go to uni. It was a question of choosing which uni and looking around different campuses. And I knew I wanted to go to uni because I was really enjoying studying, like the action of studying. I was good at it, and it was just the logical next step. I wasn't thinking about career really, other than I want to be an astronaut. Which ESA, if you're listening, call me. Keeping short-term vision and then letting future Simon worry about everything post-university. And that's worked out so well for me so far. Next, a message from Susan Ross, who is joining the pantheon of people asking us about going to university. Just to paraphrase her message, because you've written quite a lot here, Susan, it's got to be said. She's actually visited Exeter a few times, because she's been going to sixth form in Exeter and visited the campus and has been tracing where my vlogs are shot, which is quite cool. But she does say, I have no clue where you live, Dan, so you and your larger than normal forehead don't have to worry. Also, I agree about a cardiac hill. I hated having to walk from St. David's to the Harrison building in year 9. Goodness, that's a trek and a half.
It really is.
Also, I became incredibly excited when he talked about the Cauldron Inn, which is the Harry Potter themed pub, last time. And I've already messaged my Potterhead friends to arrange a visit in the last remaining weeks before we spread about the kingdom to start university. She has one question relating to university. What are your biggest pros and cons about living in halls versus living in student housing?
Halls, I had a kind of weird relationship with. As I've already touched on, it was just there to serve a purpose rather than as a kind of like a social hub. If I could redo things, I wouldn't choose catered accommodation. I'd choose self-catered, because it's quite annoying when you're just peckish and you want to make something and you don't have the facilities to really do that. Not on like, you know, obviously you can make yourself, I had a little fridge in my room and I could make myself a sandwich if I fancied it, but it gets a bit tedious after a while having to be like, oh, and with mealtimes being served in such specific times, often at the end of Evensong on a Wednesday, we'd be too late. And it was trying to make, you know, it was just a bit annoying. Student housing, on the other hand, I'm so much happier as a person now that we're here in our house.
It's a pretty great address. House.
I'm not going to say that. It's awesome. It's exactly what I hoped it would be. Not only in terms of its location and just how much it changes the lifestyle that you're leading, but also, you know, I think it's safe to say we're both blessed with pretty great company. Yeah.
The preachers are pretty great.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God. That's 2 weeks in a row.
Very good, very good.
I'm listening to the Messiah a lot, sorry. The thing I think I'd like to emphasize with Halls is the standard might not be amazing. Halls is probably 6, maybe 7 if you're lucky out of 10. It's okay accommodation. But the thing is, you're basically guaranteed okay. You're equally not guaranteed amazing, but you're not guaranteed awful. With student housing, the standard deviation on that score is much, much higher. You know, we're very lucky here. Our friend Hugo, who I just saw, has emailed us, so that's exciting. He's got an amazing house, but at the same time, there was a horror story, for example, when I was in Oxford, of a group of people from my college who went into a house, and when they turned the hot tap on, maggots came out of the taps because a rat had died in their hot water tank.
Oh my God.
And that's like a real horror story. You probably won't have anything like that. In my house, the previous owners, it was so damp that they actually got pneumonia. It wasn't the best. Oxford housing isn't great if you're living privately, it's got to be said. But the thing with halls is, yeah, you're limited, as Dan says, in other ways. And it is more expensive on the whole. Like, Exeter in particular is very expensive to live in halls.
Especially, if you go catered.
Yeah.
Just basically gives the university a license to print money. I've just spotted the three things to end on. I apologise, Dan, if my writing is terrible. I've never really been good at /understood how to do well in English, which is probably one of the reasons why I'm about to go to the university to read maths.
Good choice.
Sounds fine to me. Two, and thank God you've said this, Susan. I agree with Dan in his disgust for Simon mauling his cheese.
And three, I will be forever Team Cat, as I have an adorable fat thing called Loki. Good on you, Susan.
You've ticked two boxes there, which is very good.
Say hi to Loki for me. Scratch him behind the ears. Go on.
We've got a brief one from Henrik Stocken, again, who's written in before. Wake up, Simon. Cats are only exploiting you for food.
No, I think that's actually done in the style of Rage Against the Machine. That's, wake up! Simon, cats are only exploiting you for food!
Have you got your window open again? I really hope you haven't.
Yeah, that's open. That bad boy's open.
For God's sake. We're our neighbours' favourite people.
I'm their favourite 16-year-old girl. Oh, hang on, Henrik's just... Oh, people that do this can suck my monkey dick. Right, people that send me messages that are one sentence per message, like on Facebook, it'd be like, hello, Simon. Ding! I'm a student from India. Ding! And it's like 20 of them. It's like, put in one fucking message, right?
Yeah.
Funnily enough, you don't like salty popcorn because you're too salty from being on the losing side of the argument. Actually, no. I'm on the loosing side of the argument, apparently. I don't let anything loose other than tasty rhymes, so
for God's sake.
Suck it.
I can't hold back any longer. We're going to have to read Hugo's email. Regular readers, we'll have spoken about Hugo before. Anyway, I sent him... Well, you're hearing the email. Dear Messrs. Moore and Clark, I like your ordering there, Hugo. Well done. There is no real reason to this email. Dan Snapchatted me a podcast recording, so I want to see if the notifications for this email makes Dan look silly. I remembered to keep my laptop on silent today, so thanks for trying to...
Hey, he's learning. He can be taught.
I could say it's a gambit because if it doesn't, I'll look silly, but in hindsight, I probably look silly anyway. This is true. Love and many kisses, Hugo. P.S. Dogs are better than cats. Yes, Hugo. Yes.
He's also said, but in hindsight, I probably look silly anyway. He sounds like Gollum.
Is this a time for you to do your impression?
I could say it's a gambit, because if it doesn't, I will look silly. But in hindsight, I probably look silly anyway.
Very good. He's such a talent.
It's one of the very few I can do. F*** Off you go. Next, an email from a previous correspondent, JamieJX93. Dear Messrs. Clark and Moore, good ordering. Once again, I thank you for an excellent podcast. They really have improved the ambience of my Saturday morning walk, which is the longest of any of the walks I do during the week. We're very glad to help. Firstly, on the dogs versus cats debate, much as I am an adherent to Clark Catholicism, I'm afraid my belief cannot extend to that of preferring cats over dogs. Can we set this as Clark Catholicism and Mormonism?
More, yeah.
Those are the two religions of the podcast.
Okay.
And of course, you're wrong here, James. You're a heretic in the Church of Clark Catholicism. Report to penitence. I mean, I read 40K, so my idea of religion is pretty fucked up. Don't worry. Dogs are, in fact, the superior creature, as they have been domesticated and trained to perform tasks such as being guide dogs, sheep herding dogs, police dogs, etc., while cats perform no such task and are generally a bit useless.
Very true. Very, very, very true.
As my dad always used to say, our cat Henry could have been turned into a lovely pair of gloves. Also, he used to try and kill Dad every day by tripping him up on the stairs, which is what he would have done to any intruder. So yeah. he was a good boy. Secondly, salted popcorn is better than sweet popcorn. #ProudBarbarian. Report to heresy school. Honestly, you are going to be purged. What's that? Hang on, I'm getting a call from the Holy Inquisition. Yeah, they're going to be coming for you. They're going to be coming for you, Jamie.
Look, I usually prefer sweet, but every now and then, and it's only when I go to the cinema without you, I will order salty.
I'll order it when they're out of sweet.
Also, does one truly ever order popcorn? That sounds far too civilized for a cinema.
Excuse me, sir. Hello.
It's like you. Popcorn, yeah. It's like you checking into a club.
I'm inexperienced in clubs. All right.
Okay.
And he signed off with "Tinkety Tonk, old fruit, and down with the Nazis," James.
Which I love. That's amazing. That's a reference to Simon and Mayo, isn't it?
Oh, is it? Oh, I thought it was like a danger five where it's just like, and as always, kill Hitler.
Yeah, and well, I certainly know that it's something for... We've spoken about the podcast before, but BBC Radio 5 Live do an amazing film podcast with Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo, and it's amazing and you should listen to it.
Now we come to the strangest part of the podcast, which has become a feature now, where Dan and I read out strange fan fiction that's been sent in about us. I'm reading this week, so brace yourself, Dan. Close that tab, and I'm going to enlighten you with The Case of the Deleted Pixels by Josh Baker.
Right.
Apologies if your fan fiction that you sent in has not been read out this week. We do have like a list of them, and this is the one we just decided to go with this week. But The Case of the Deleted Pixels. This is chapter 2, if you remember. This is the murder mystery where Pixel Girl and Liv are two different people. Right. So, chapter 2. Liv quickly led Dan and Simon across Exeter, ducking through alleys and roadways. Eventually, they came out along New N, right alongside an old brook across from a pub. New N sounds like a sci-fi name for one thing, but then it's beside a brook across from a pub, which is possibly, like, is this Bree? Is Exeter the village of Bree?
Is the pub called the Inn of the Prancing Pony?
There was police tape all across the wooded area, and officials stood around, keeping passers-by from interfering. The trio made their way through the crowd and walked up to the man who appeared to be in charge. Simon flashed his wallet and stated, "Simon Clark, atmospheric physicist. What have we got?" I love this. So it's like Murder, She Wrote. I'm just like, yeah. Jessica Fletcher. It's like, excuse me, I'm important. Hello.
Yeah.
What's the crime? The officer nodded and replied, "Glad you could make it." So should I do voices for this?
If you like.
"Glad you could make it. I'm Inspector Strillard. Afraid it's not pretty." He stepped aside to reveal a mess of pixels strewn across the damp earth. A poorly rendered body lay there, bloody and torn.
God.
There was no mistaking. It was Pixel Girl.
No.
Dan immediately set to examining the wounds. There appears to be blunt trauma to the forehead.
All right, hang on. Whoa, 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 whoa. No, I'm not having any of that. No way,
I'm
sir.
Harry Potter.
Expelliarmus. Expelliarmus.
Oh, Hagrid. So right, where was I? "There appears to be blunt trauma to the forehead, but not randomly placed. Such this was no accident." Simon checked the surrounding area while Liv silently wept, and Dan tried to console her. I definitely nearly read that as "try to console her," like you were playing her like a PS4.
Yeah.
He looked into the trees above the scene and noticed the distinctive pattern of cuts made through the bush. He motioned to Dan to follow him, and they stepped away from the crowd. Simon told him, "Notice the markings in the leaves. Whoever did this attack from above."
Hang on, if we're going to do your voice, it needs to be accurate.
But it's me.
"Notice the markings in the leaves. Whoever also did this attack from above."
It sounds like an Attenborough rather than anything else. Simon told him, "Notice the markings in the leaves. Whoever did this attacked from above." Dan replied, "Is there any way to tell how he/she managed it?" Simon shook his head.
"There is one way, but it will require the full force of my doctorate knowledge and scripting ability to determine."
Dan nodded and looked at the body again.
"Such a shame. I had considered asking her out once."
I don't mind the squeaky high voice, but I'm not fucking Cockney, all right? I was raised well.
It's been... Oh, wow, burn on Cockney people. My God.
Sorry, mate.
This is very weird, by the way. You've thought about asking Pixel Girl out. It's like the Liv and, I'm going out with Liv and you were thinking of going out with Pixel Girl.
Oh, wait.
Also...
I just breezed across that.
Also, Liv is just like weeping. We're the men in this situation. We're damn it. We're the people that are going to deal with the crime. Liv's like a poor, squishy girl with all her emotions. Leave it to the men.
Yeah.
Because that's how reality is, folks.
Of course, yeah.
That was a joke. Please don't hate me. That was, of course, a joke. Liv, please don't kill me. Simon put his
put his shandy down.
Simon put his hand on his friend's shoulder and sighed.
"I was rooting for you, buddy. Oh, well. We need to find out who's responsible, and fast, before they strike again."
To be continued. If we don't track them to the savannah of Africa, then that's going to be a waste of that voice.
"And here we see..." "Here we see the murderer. Inside a gazelle. He clearly watched The Revenant last night."
For context, we've just been watching The Revenant.
Yeah, that wasn't just a really random reference. Yeah. Well, Josh, I'm really interested to see where you go with this. Also, be careful what you write about Dan and Pixel Girl, because I don't have ownership over Pixel Girl. Also, well, I kind of do in that I made the character, but
if we can get some direction on my voice, I'm not totally sold on that.
I think that's exactly what you sound like.
Okay.
I don't hear any difference between when I hear it back. I'm gonna be like, well, it's like Dan's talking.
Right.
Mate,
okay.
I'm reading this one out.
Just remember what I'm saying, Josh, because I'm reading everything next week. I'm basically going to read you like you've made a Dungeons and Dragons character with an intellect of one.
"We got to find the murderer." "Cochlear, I need a new cochlear."
Oh, no. Oh god, I totally forgot about that.
So, Daniel, what have we learned this week?
Well, we've been on a heck of a journey. We had a very, very deep conversation about fantasy and sci-fi and how cultures involved with those two things and sport then reflect...
What was the article, though? What was the Wikipedia article we started on?
Oh, now that's a question. It had something to do with a coat of arms in Germany.
There is a coat of arms in it. It rhymes with a camp.
Champ?
Damp? We're talking about Krauschwitz, which was a municipality in East Germany, near Poland.
Okay.
And that wasn't very much to talk about. So we immediately started talking about Warhammer, because it sounds like a location in Warhammer. And then from there, everything you just said.
Yeah. Also, chess?
Yeah, we're talking about chess. Wizards chess, 3D chess. How we became interested in sci-fi and fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a whole bunch of correspondence and a really intriguing... fan fiction this week.
Yeah, I'm excited to see where this goes. It's got legs. That's all for this week's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to us on your podcasting service of choice. You can like us on Facebook, and if you'd like to see our faces, check out our YouTube channel, Spongy and Electric.
Warhammer army lists, coat of arm recommendations, and other thoughts on the show can be sent to us at spongyelectric@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.
Join us again for another tumble down the wiki rabbit hole, and we'll see you next time.